Look at that. Protección. Sí. You need it here. I mean, we have a lot of it here already.
Yo sé. Porque cuando, siempre cuando entro en México, y sé que es súper como desarrollado y mis parientes tienen como casas en pinche Puerto Vallarta, caballos ricos. Pero cuando yo entro aquí, siempre tengo un poquito nervioso. Like, como hay un chance que no regrese.
Que no regrese. Yeah. I get the same when I go to Chicago.
Really? It's so nice there, though.
It is, though. I went to a place where they have the pork chop sandwiches with the bone left in there.
Yeah, I think I went there. It's called Portillo's.
Yeah.
Portillo. They call it Portillo's.
No. This was a very dark, black neighborhood.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was not safe, apparently, when I was there. I was like wandering like a tourist, like a upside down tourist, I guess. It was weird.
Yeah. Anyway,
thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming down.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure.
I know this is not your first time here or in Mexico or in Latin America generally. You had some adventures.
Yeah. Not so much in Mexico. You know, I've been here a bunch, but it's always
further down. Colombia, Medellin.
Yeah, Medellin, Bogota.
Yeah. You still have your liver and your kidneys intact and everything like that. You can wake up in a tub down there.
Are they organ harvesting down there?
I've heard stories. I mean, they do it here in Mexico every now and then. You'll hear stories about, you know, people found empty. I don't know.
That's how they characterize people in LA. Empty.
Yeah. We met each other on your pod. Well, basically, you were kindly, you're kind enough to invite me on your podcast, which is great.
No, you were kind enough to come up. I mean, trust me, that episode's doing great.
I've been following you. Like, you basically, I found out about you during COVID. Like, everybody was like locked in, and all of a sudden, your name started coming up, and people were like, hey, check this guy. He's got a telling some of the insider secrets of what's going on and how they move things around. I've like looked at you. Like when you hear drug trafficking, organized crime and all that stuff, you don't usually, you know, imagine, you know, a guy about your height. And
right.
But I started listening to some of your conversations and how openly you were talking about, you know, what you were involved in.
Snitching.
Yeah. I know enough about that world that I know you never name names, you never go into details about certain things, and also you did time, and you did time, and you're alive, so it means if you were that, you probably wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, well, you know, the fact is most people that are sitting in federal prison probably cooperated in some sense. I wasn't in federal prison. I was in the state. Just this is how brutal America is. You get caught selling drugs. They make you snitch and you got to go do your time. What a horrendous system. But I didn't. I was able to dodge cooperation and a long prison sentence.
You were involved in trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you... You know, not to snitch it again, you know, like or do any of that shit. But basically, like you're from Seattle,
Portland. But it's like Seattle.
It's kind of like Seattle. The last time I was there, I got involved in some gender pronoun thing. Like I'm new to the country and I don't know how anything works, you know. And somebody was like, "Azur."
Really?
Yeah, I got some of that.
Who are you hanging around with when you go to these cities?
Usually, I get hosted. I do classes out there at 10 Planet Jiu-Jitsu, which those guys are great. But I had somebody kind of lecture me on gender pronouns, and I don't know a lot about that. I mean, it's new to me, I guess, you know? Like, I'm open to anything.
Like, we just stopped hitting our wives in Mexico. Like, don't make us... Like, let's baby step it.
Yeah, like slow down. Like I'm just learning. You know, so they hit me with that, and I've hit them with emigrante. And I won that. Portland. How's that? How's growing up in Portland?
So we had none of that. Like that kind of ultra leftist or woke, you know, psychotic culture. There was none of that. I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, so it was just like a port city, right? It was a real great place to grow up, very middle class, but it was diverse back then too. Now it's not as diverse. a lot of gentrification. All the black people from my neighborhood basically sold their houses and got out. But yeah, everybody was involved in like drug trafficking and especially pot because that's where it comes from.
Yeah, I mean, it's green out there and rains a lot. Mm-hmm. That's perfect environment for pot grows.
Yeah. So we always knew somebody like this turns out this guy's uncle who dressed in like Birkenstocks, right? Dork, white guy with a huge beard. Like, you know, he got arrested. He did time back in the day he was a gigantic smuggler. So that was pretty common.
Just pot.
Back
then it was
amongst the white people. Yeah. Yeah.
What were your life plans when you were young? Like back then, like where were you headed mentally before that turn?
Not recalcitrant. It's incorrigible. Yeah, I just wanted to be rich. I wanted to not have a job and I wanted to do whatever I wanted to do. I wanted to, you know, a lot of what I ended up doing is what I wanted to do. I wanted to travel in Latin America, you know, take private planes, you know, ball out, sleep with a bunch of, you know, probably professional sex workers who they called, but said they weren't, said they love me.
You hide your valuables before you get them in.
For sure.
You probably were watching Scarface and shit like that.
Yeah, of course. That was a huge influence. That was a huge, dude. Scarface was a huge influence on, because people like.
But that was supposed to be made to warn you about that lifestyle.
I know.
But did you just watch half of it? Just stop it at the middle?
This is the rationalization. And all the rappers, if you listen to all the rap songs, they say, be Sosa, not Tony. So you want to be Sosa, because Sosa got away.
Yeah, yeah. He Sosa lived.
Yeah.
Shit.
If hustling is a must, be Sosa, not Tony. That's a rap line. Yeah, and I was like, okay, yeah, I'll just do it better. Yeah, he shows us what not to do.
Yeah, that's a cautionary tale, just to divert. What was your first exposition into this kind of like lifestyle? It was like who was the entry? What was the entry for
friends?
You?
So friends in high school had parents. Black guys had, you know, fathers who they were involved in crack. Pimping. I'm not trying to make a stereotype. This is just
that was around, yeah.
And so, you know, like I think my first the guy that I first, you know, bought my first ounce of weed from back in like 2002, I was 16. He, you know, his dad had just got out of prison. And so, but he was already back like living in like a luxury hotel. You know, I walked in, he had two of his hoes cuz he was a pimp too. He had gator shoes. Lined up from like wall to wall, and he was like smoking weed in bed, and he had these two black, like very well-built black women, you know, hoes, and he was very rude and gruff, but like my good friend who I went to high school with, he vouched for me.
Yeah.
And so he's the one who put me on, and I was like, wow, this is the craziest thing ever.
When you go there and you get that access, is it fear or excitement that's in you?
Excitement and fascination.
Yeah.
Because like I never thought when I would watch movies about, you know, these people that blew up to then get arrested and go do life in prison for drugs. I'm like, how do you even get to that point to where you can sell? Like I didn't understand like distribution. That's what fascinated me. Yeah. I'm like, because I didn't know anybody who used drugs, you know, cocaine, much less like, yeah, we all like smoked weed. It's like broke high school kids bought $10 bags, but like, Where's all this economy come from? Where do these buyers come from? It's like the free market, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, so I was really fascinated by it. Like, how can I figure this out as a business?
You walk into this hotel room with an advertisement for what the life would bring you.
Right, right.
What's that first? I mean, basically, how I know it works with some of these guys is first they test you.
Yeah, no, I think this guy was, because I was with his son, he was like, okay, this kid clearly, I mean, I had my backpack on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was just a skinny, like, I'm not wearing a wire. You know, I was a fucking child, right? So, but I had money. Yeah. I had money. I never took any product fronted to me. So it really, you know. In America, it's especially with weed, even back then, the supply nearly outweighed the demand. So people got to move it, you know?
Yeah.
So people got to move it. It's like, you know, even in high level drug trafficking, meth, cocaine, heroin, it's like people take chances even with people that they are a little suspicious of usually because they got to get the product off, you know?
Did you get any feeling that your race and your appearance was probably part of the motivation for you to be hired by this individual?
Yeah, I think in Portland, it's not really like that because it's so white. Yeah. Black people just have. If you discriminated against every white person, you'd never sell anything.
Never sell anything.
Yeah,
yeah, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
You start moving weed.
Yeah,
that's the first
entry
into it, and it's, you know, there's a lot of it probably.
Yes, but you could still make money back then. But it was always competitive in the Northwest. So you know.
When you say competitive, I mean. Are there like rival distributors?
Yeah, it's all.
If you get caught selling where you're not supposed to be selling, well, none of that.
It's all free market. It's all like, smokers are going to go to whoever has the best price and the best product. It's beautiful. It's how economy should work on a principle level. So no, it's not like selling crack in Chicago, selling heroin in Baltimore. I was working off a pager and a cell phone pretty much from the time that I started.
What type of cell phone?
It had Snake on it. You remember Snake? Yeah. It was like a Nokia.
These Nokia indestructible phones that you use as a bludgeoning device.
Exactly. Well, actually, it was, yes, correct. And it was like it had an antenna.
Yeah.
And I bought an ounce of weed. I bought a scale, baggies, and that was my first cell phone.
Yeah.
I didn't have a cell phone until 2004. So I had a pager. That's how I started. But I was like, this is not effective.
So were you delivering basically?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I had weed at school, you know, kept it in the locker, all that shit. So it was real amateur shit. And we were just major potheads.
Yeah.
And I had no idea until I got to college how to like scale that up.
You're in college. What was your aim in college? I mean, was it? I imagine it wasn't basically that path, life path.
I mean, again, I had no idea. I'm like, let me just pay my rent off of it.
Yeah, sustain.
And I started paying my rent off of it, and I'm like, how can this possibly get any better? I'm making like, I'm making like $1,500 a month. What?
Wow.
What have I done to deserve such riches? Because, you know, it was the cost of living back then. We were just hooligans and we just partied all the time. And I got good grades, you know, like I got through school. I was always a pretty good student. But it was just, it took years before it really leveled up.
Yeah. College, what were you seeing in college that changed your outlook as far as growth?
I was seeing white boys bringing in like 20, 30, 40 pounds into Eugene, where I went to school, University of Oregon, and getting rid of them every week. And I was like, holy shit, this is fucking ballers.
That's volume.
Yeah, exactly. They're okay. I'm like, okay, they can do it. That's when like the urgency stepped in. I'm like, okay, I have to figure this out.
Did you reach back to your contacts in the past, or how were you figuring out where to get it now?
No, so this is where we figure out, okay, I need to buy in bulk at the best price because this is how I'm going to get, I need to step up from hand-to-hand sales and start supplying dealers. And above that, I need to start supplying wholesalers who are supplying dealers, you know? So that's the key back then was the best price, and you got that by buying directly from the growers. So there were two main demographics of weed growers back then, right? Well, actually three. One of them was like the indoor hydroponic grow scene.
Indoor grows that never get snow on their roofs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because it's stupid.
Yeah.
Insulate, guys. Insulate. I've heard.
And, you know, sometimes you would hear about big grow operations by, like, Asian gangs. They were doing that even back then.
Yeah.
Because they're just, you know, they're smart. And they
organized.
Yeah, they're organized. They can get people from China to come over to be straw buyers, to purchase houses, to, you know, in their grandmother's name, set them up. But those were always getting popped because, you know, it was very difficult to figure out how to hide where all that power usage was coming from.
Yeah, power usage. Yeah. And this is a time when helicopters were being used probably and thermal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Signatures, yeah, and heat, a bunch
heat,
of ways.
Heat and infrared and stuff like that. So the prices on those wholesale pounds were always high. That was always premium.
Yeah.
I dealt with that stuff, but.
And was it better?
Of course. No, it was fire. It would blow your head off. Like we called it fire. That was like top of the line, like White Widow. Like it didn't even look like weed. It was just
White Widow.
The crystals frosty, were dancing. Frosted.
Frosted.
Yeah. It looked like frosted flakes, but with more sugar on it. So it was like unnecessary.
Yeah.
I mean, some smokers wanted that exclusively, but the majority of the market could accept what we called like commercial.
Yeah.
Which was grown outdoors in the forests of Southern Oregon or Northern California. And this was really good outdoor weed. People on like the East Coast, the Midwest, certainly in Mexico, would look at it and think it was grown indoors.
Yeah.
It was very good, but you could move it at a high volume quickly. It was like middle class. So I'm like, okay, that's a good target. So the two groups that were growing that outdoor en masse bud that you could buy wholesale, if you were, you know, picked up 50 at a time, I could get it for like 1800 or 2000. Those were the rednecks. I called them rednecks, but they were just, you know, these blue collar ex hippies who live in these small towns, right? In Mendocino County and Humboldt County.
And these are probably guys.
Shasta County.
And these are probably guys that own their own land and have.
Yes.
That's their property. Yeah. And they're growing it on their property.
Exactly. And by 2007, 2008, there's medical marijuana that's legal in. So you can grow a certain amount of plants, right? 10, 15, 20 plants, whatever your card allows. So what they would do is all the neighbors would get cards and they would combine grows to get like, you know, 100 plants, 200 plants each. You get like 2 or 3 pounds off a plant. It's a nice little, you know, say like $1 million a year operation, but it's a nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what the Mexicans were doing. And that's where you're going to get the best price because
that's a third option.
Yeah. And that was the main, for me, that was the main option. I'm like, I have to get to those guys because they're the ones sent up from, you know, the Golden Triangle, Durango, Sinaloa, Chihuahua.
People basically learn their craft down here.
Yeah.
And are going to set up, they're probably crossed illegally or made their way up there and like, what can I do up here?
Yeah, well, I think this is how it worked because I got to know my guy pretty well by the end. So they would send up basically somebody from one of these areas, probably Culiacan, you know, the heart of Sinaloa, the heart of the headquarters.
Yeah.
Some person would... He would be the organizer. He would get funded from the bosses, right?
Yeah.
And he would basically hire a crew of obradores, laborers, right? Farmers. And they would all strike it. Yes, enter illegally. And then, you know, basically set up shop in one of these little towns, Crescent City. I mean, you got to have to look it up on a map.
Yeah.
Like so remote up there in on the border with Oregon and Northern California. And they would just march as far up into the woods as you possibly can. And, you know,
federal land.
Yeah. Federal land. And they would, you know, find clearings and, they would rig irrigation and just, you know, these are genius farmers. They'd find where the light would hit it appropriately. And, you know, you could get, thousands of pounds every harvest that way.
All you really need is irrigation, a little bit of pesticides for some of these.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, good orientation as far as the sun. And I mean, water is plentiful up there.
You know,
some of the places that they grow some of that shit down in Baja, for example, I found a few of those giant fields down here. Not a lot of water. So they would have to figure out water, and the weed was garbage.
Really?
Yeah, the weed was not at any level as what you find up there.
Have they figured that out, how to grow better weed in Baja?
It's become not even, most of the weed trafficking happens from San Diego down to
Right.
So it's become like a non-problem.
How wild is that? There's cross, I'm going to talk about that in my video, how the drugs are flowing south now.
Yeah, yeah. The weed, I mean, Tijuana is full of gringos smoking California weed in Mexico, which is pretty funny.
And is it, are there dispensaries yet where it's sold out of, or it's still all underground?
It's nebulous and people are being paid off, and it's, you know, it's around, it's everywhere. It's just, you know, it's still nebulous and still a cause to get some bullshit with the cops.
Just like everything in Mexico, nobody really knows.
Yeah, no, it's
don't know the true story.
We don't know. So you figure out an economic source that is Mexican, basically growing some of this stuff on federal lands and not taking a lot of risk around it, probably employing the cheapest labor out there, which is illegal labor, and doing it all to supply people like you that were then gonna. Was there any conversation when you started getting into a relationship with them about anything? I mean, are they just supplying you and not in leaving you alone to your work?
Yeah, of course. Of course. There was no kind of
no control or oversight.
No. Just
here you go.
I mean, my guy, you know, who I developed a relationship with, when you bring somebody, you know, $250,000 every month, you develop a kinship with them. So, and I never saw these grows. He would meet me at a hotel in Garberville, which is a depressed logging town. All the industry has fled. You know, it's collapsed since like the 70s when the logging industry took a shit. But hotel rooms there, you know, during the fall go for $200 a night. Explain that to me. It's because millions of dollars every day were exchanged behind those doors. So everybody from all over the country would descend on these places to find a re-up like that.
Did you get a sense of permissiveness at an official level? I mean, there's that amount of business going on there. Yeah. I can't imagine there's a sheriff's office somewhere around the area.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely sketchy because they would know where the cars would be leaving out of and looking to pick people off. So I always paid a little bit more usually to have them meet me, you know, a few towns up, like drive an hour and a half. I'll pay $100 extra just to be in.
To lessen the risk.
Yeah, exactly. I also had people driving for me by the end.
So you wouldn't take any other, that specific risk of the pickup?
Exactly. Just because it's such a long drive and I, you know, by then I had a felony, so I'm not taking the risk.
You're growing exponentially from this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about $250,000.
That was just in the re-up. That was just the re-up, the buy money.
Yeah. You are employing other people.
Are you? Not many, though. It's a pretty skeleton crew.
Yeah.
So one guy driving, one guy stashing, and then my partner.
Yeah. You like, when you go about building something like this, are you actually looking at people? Are you doing your homework on people when you start letting them in? Like, what's that process like?
Yeah, well,
like, who do you trust, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was cowboy about it. Like, I really never thought about the cops until it finally happened, which is such a white privilege, if you want to use that term, which I hate. But it really is. Like, black people just have to think about cops more when they're selling drugs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's I get it.
It makes them better drug dealers when you got to be on your toes.
Yeah.
But I was the only time I was worried about cops was on the drive back north.
Back. Yeah.
Getting pulled over, getting, you know, I never thought I would get big enough to where like they would try to tap my phone or, you know, somebody would wear a wire. I just didn't think it could happen. It was delusional.
You didn't look for it. You didn't.
Yeah. I was more worried about getting robbed. I was definitely, that happened. You know, people getting stuck up because weed was very valuable. That's how people got in business.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't go get a micro loan if you want to buy, you know, these Mexicans specifically, but a lot of these big growers, if you didn't have 40 or 50 grand to spend, they wouldn't even meet with you. So how are you going to get that money if you're just like a 20, 21-year-old kid? And say you got clientele, you can move it. You'll just go, you go take somebody's stash and then you sell it. Now you're in business. Yeah. So that was very common. So I was always on high alert for that.
And security wise, are you arming yourself?
No.
Are you looking into that? Are you just realizing that that would make things worse?
It would make things worse. It would make the criminal penalties higher. And
were these basically, you were educating yourself on just seeing other people getting fucking picked up with guns. And you're like, well, not do that.
For sure. And it just wasn't in like, it wasn't in our nature. And I'm like, okay, if I'm getting robbed, I'm fucking up. I need to tighten up. So, you know, the first time we got stuck up at gunpoint, we never made the same mistake again to allow that to happen. You know,
how much were you robbed of? Like, was it substantial as far as like,
no, I mean, if they had hit the mother load, it would have taken everything. But I think they got like a pound, maybe 2 pounds and like $400 in cash. Cause we had moved it, you know, they robbed our house in college where we lived, and we were keeping the load at a stash house. So, you know, good on us.
lesson learned. You're growing, I imagine, at this point. Like, what you say, there's almost like a personal relationship with your contact, right? I imagine he's Mexican. I imagine he's from a very specific part of Mexico.
He was the guy. So I didn't know these guys were from Sinaloa until I actually went to Sinaloa and I heard the accent. And I'm like, oh, yeah, these dudes are because I just heard la verga, toda la verga. La verga. Yeah. It would not stay with everything was to the dick. La verga.
It's our version of fuck. Yeah. Está de la verga means it's very bad.
Yeah.
Or estás bien verga means you're a good motherfucker, right?
Yeah.
But he
was the one who spoke he was the only one who spoke some English. Yeah. And that therefore he was the ambassador to the distributors like me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now when Americans think of it's a cartel guy, you know, they probably think pointy boots, weird silk shirts with a cock and an eagle or something like that on their gold chain. Was there any of that?
He was my age and he had an LA Dodger cap on and he was skinny. All of the farmers, because sometimes he would bring his guys to be in the hotel room while we were counting out. They were like the fatter laborers.
Yeah.
He was the guy who maybe had family here. He had some kind of cross-border connection.
Pocho. He was probably pocho, you know, basically born
right,
out.
Right.
Probably kids up there already trying to make his life up there.
Yes, or he was sent early, so now he's able to enter legally. Maybe he has a work permit, like whatever it is. He was, you know, he was the guy that I dealt with.
You're developing a relationship with him. You know, I mean, that's a lot of money. So I imagine they themselves want to keep you're a client of theirs, so you want to keep happy. Do you get any source of threats, any sort of threatening, like if you don't deliver, like you see this shit in fiction, you know?
Yeah.
And on the other end, when you realize, when you see some of this shit for real life, I mean, you're both taking a fucking risk. Yeah. And those who suffer together, you know, because it's in a lot of ways, develop a lot of, there's a big relationship there. Do you notice any sort of like threat, or if you lose this, is there any of that going on, or is it just like, hey, we're friends and we have a business relationship, just, you know, as soon as I hand this over to you, it's on you, and
exactly,
there you go.
Exactly. I mean, at one point, towards, you know, we're creeping into like 2009 to the early 2010, the supply starts to really start to meet parity with demand in the Northwest. So now these growers are having a harder time moving it, right? Moving it fast and getting the prices that they want. So so the growers really started like bargaining with me. They would say, here, if you want to pay for 40, we'll give you another 40.
Okay.
And I said, no, I don't want to take that risk. Because then maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe if something fucked up, maybe they would, you know, send somebody after me to try to collect. But no, there was no, weed's pretty chill, even at high levels, you know, and because remember, when everybody's making a ton of money, it goes against logic why anybody would behave really, savagely.
Yeah. Yeah. you start off there, I imagine. So when does it change into other things?
Well, I only sold cocaine at low levels,
yeah,
like before the weed business really took off. I did it because it was just a good, I just wanted to diversify my revenue streams.
Was it sourced basically from some of the same?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think I got up to like a quarter key, 9 ounces. And I would do that because from, you know, end of June, beginning of July through, you know, sometimes as late as like early October, the weed supply would start to dry up. Now, people that are younger don't comprehend what I'm saying, but it would literally all of the weed, there was a limited supply of outdoor grown weed.
It's a season.
It would get sold out.
It's a seasonal thing.
Yeah. So the prices would go up, the quality would go down, and so you would be dry. You don't have any dope to sell. And so that's when I would turn to coke.
Despite the common weed does give you like withdrawals. There's weed withdrawals for people. Like people get really moody and shit like that. It's fine though. It's a great drug.
Well, I got withdrawals from, because I'm burning a hole from cash.
Yeah.
I got cash withdrawals.
Cash withdrawals.
Yeah.
To people that you say quarter key.
Yeah.
How much is
quarter kilo's nine ounces?
Back then, how much would that be?
We're paying, I could get it if I bought nine at a time, I could get it for $600 to $700 an ounce. Yeah. Didn't have to step on it. It was just really, really high quality coke. It's before fentanyl. So I would break it down into 8 balls, 0.5 ounces. And I even sold grams. I try to just, the beauty of cocaine, of selling cocaine, is that you can take a small amount. You can be low level and still make a high quality. If you're buying it from a wholesaler, and you have that plug, then you don't have to sell to distributors and take a risk that they're going to get popped and come back and rat you out.
Yeah.
I know that most people I'm selling to are just using it up right there. Some people I would hit off with like 0.5 ounces. They would go back and sell it. But
back then, who were you, like, who's buying this? Because you hear about this, how coke is still like, it's still the caffeine, you know, of the U.S.
like most used drug.
Who's buying it?
So, well, in Eugene, it was like college students, like frat boys, the Jewish frat, like they're staying up studying for finals. It would be, I had some black guys that I think were cooking it up into crack. They were the only people that I sold to that I knew were reselling it.
Yeah.
And just, you know, white girls partying. That was mainly the college. That was in college. Then in Portland, I was selling it to like professionals, lawyers, people I met through. I sold coke to somebody I met through like a professor I had at U of O.
Sure.
So, you know.
Basically, it's a performance enhancer.
Yeah, because you just meet one person, and then they introduce you to 10 of their friends. Cokeheads all move in a circle.